A man who claimed to be the final prophet, with the ability to convince droves to follow him and believe his teachings. In modern times, characters like these rarely pass through society in peace. David Koresh is no different. That is today on The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
David Koresh. Born Vernon Wayne Howell on August 17, 1959, was an American cult leader who played a central role in the Waco siege of 1993. As the head of the Branch Davidian sect, Koresh claimed to be its final prophet. Coming from a dysfunctional background, Koresh was a member and later a leader of the Branch Davidians, a movement led by Benjamin Rodin that splintered off from the Davidian Seventh-day Adventist Church, also known as the Shepherd's Rods, based at the Mount Carmel Center outside Waco, Texas. Here, Koresh competed for dominance with another leader named George Rodin, until Rodin was jailed for murdering another rival. So that's where we'll start the conversation today about David Koresh here on The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Tony and Carol Hughes joining you for today's episode. It's an interesting story. And what I have found interesting over the last several years, just as as information is available to us in ways that we obviously did not have in 1993, when this all happened, it's interesting, very interesting on this story to see the other side of the story. And I saw it presented in a docu-series. It's on Netflix now. I think this is called Koresh. It was originally aired 3 or 4 years ago on a cable network, but now everybody's seeing it because it's Netflix. But it was really well done. And really, I think, interestingly tells the story of what happened behind the scenes at that compound. And puts a lot of humanity into it, where it was presented to us by the government at the time of, you know, these are bad people, bad, bad. And then it kind of, we started to see really this was really kind of out of hand, extremely the way it was all handled. But anyway, interesting to see things from the other side all these years later. Carol?
No, I agree with you. I think that, because I remember when it happened.
Yeah.
And it went on for days and days and weeks.
Yeah.
And everyone knew there was only going to be a bad ending. So as an outsider watching it unfold, you could tell it wasn't, this is not going to end well.
Sure.
And the fact that they just kept pushing it, like the government, like kept pushing it and pushing it, I think that it kind of, by their actions, sort of validated everything he was saying to his followers.
Yeah.
So to his followers, it's like, yeah, he said this would happen and it's happening. And so I don't know. There's got to be people who were there and in charge who have looked back on that every single day of their life since and thought, something different could have been done.
Yeah, and I think a lot of them have done that. I think they've said some of those things in some documentary series and things where they've really looked into the whole case. You know, what this is just interesting, this is my perspective, because I remember the whole David Koresh thing. I was a news junkie, you know, since I could really understand the news. But I would still do kid-like things with this, like, affinity for things that are like something for a 30-some-year-old or older, but I'd be playing with Legos. I remember specifically when Koresh was going on, because I would always watch World News Tonight with Peter Jennings while playing with Legos. Because I was about 11 or so when this went down. But I had a Lego Peter Jennings. And I had a Lego news set all set up. So the Legos were like film. We're always doing the
only
news.
Only you.
I know. I like, if you go back, I still have my Lego collection for my kids. And I would write on them on the sides with like Sharpie. And at one point, I had all the networks. I had CBS, I had NBC, I had ABC, and it like they'd have their newscasts. And but you'd see the, I have like the CBS logo on my Legos and little Lego cameras that say like ABC News and all this shit.
God,
and,
that is adorable.
Yeah. And so that's how I played with my Legos. But the thing is, they needed things to go and report on. So I would build with the Legos the scenes of like the news of what's going on. So if there, you know, there'd be like city streets someday, some days there'd be locations. I remember I built, this is, sounds horrible, but I was 11 years old at the time. So I could have the reporter reporting about what was going on. I remember building like, and this is the building that this is going on at. So the little Lego reporters could do their story and then throw it back to Dan Rather. So it was like, this is how I could come up with and create the different shit I would build with my Legos. It was based on current news events. So this is
so
Tony at 11.
Built that whole fortress thing in Waco. Like,
well, I mean, I had a deadline to meet. The news was at 5 o'clock or 5:30. So I couldn't build it that elaborately, but I built a little structure and then the reporter was out in front of it, you know, and that's what it was. I didn't like go into great detail on that one. But there was many different things. Like there was some big plane crashes back in the 90s and 80s. And I would build like out of Legos that, and then have the reporter reporting on it. That, I don't know. It's so weird, but this is my 11-year-old brain.
It is so you, though.
Yeah, that's how what I would do.
Like it, I think it's adorably cute, and it doesn't surprise me at all.
So it's like
though.
Disturbing in a way when I talk about it, because it's like you would like build plane crash scenes. Have a report.
Well, we're like, reporting on it. It's news.
It's news, and so I mean, because at that age, I wanted to be a reporter, and then I started to get more into music, and I was actually calling into a radio station. I would flip between playing radio station and newscaster. I'd always be doing the two, but it would take just a call to the radio station that I would obsessively request songs from every single lunch hour. Her name was Liz Seidel. And I called her and she's like, "Hey, Tony," because she knew me by first name at this point. And I requested my Ace of Base song. And she's like, "What do you want to do when you grow up?" I'm like, "Huh." Nobody had really asked me at this point, even though I'm obsessively doing this career-like job every day of media. And she's like, "Would you want to be a radio DJ someday?" I'm like, "I think that sounds like fun." And then about a year and a half later, I was working at the radio station with her. So...
That's crazy.
Yeah, that was the early life there. Anyway, let's continue on with the early life of our crazy person today, David Koresh, here on the dark side of Wikipedia. David Koresh was born Vernon Wayne Howell on August 17, 1959 in Houston, Texas, to a 14-year-old single mother, Bonnie Sue Clark, and father Bobby Wayne Howell before Koresh was born. His father met another teenage girl and abandoned Bonnie Sue. Koresh never met his father, and his mother began cohabitating with a violent alcoholic. In 1963, Koresh's mother left with her boyfriend and placed her 4-year-old son in the care of his maternal grandmother, Earlene Clark. His mother returned when he was 7 after her marriage to a carpenter named Roy Haldeman. Bonnie Sue and Haldeman had a son together named Roger, who was born in 1966. Koresh described his early childhood as lonely. Due to his poor study skills and dyslexia, he was put in special education classes and nicknamed Vernie by his fellow students. Koresh dropped out of Garland High School in his junior year. When he was 19 years old, Koresh had an illegal sexual relationship with a 15-year-old girl who became pregnant. He claimed to have become a born-again Christian in the Southern Baptist Church and soon joined his mother's church, a Seventh-day Advent Church. There, he became infatuated with the pastor's daughter, and while praying for guidance, he opened his eyes and allegedly found the Bible opened at Isaiah 34:16, stating that none should want for her mate. Convinced this was a sign from God, he approached the pastor and told him that God wanted him to have his daughter for a wife. The pastor threw him out, and when he continued to persist with the pursuit of the daughter, he was expelled from the congregation. In 1981, Koresh moved to Waco, Texas, where he joined the Branch Davidians, not to be confused with the original Davidian Seventh-day Adventist group. Benjamin Rodin, who died in 1978, originated the Branch group in 1955 with new teachings that were not connected with the original Davidians. Koresh played guitar and sang in church services at the Mount Carmel Center, the sect's headquarters, outside Waco. Ascent to leadership of the Branch Davidians. In 1983, Koresh began claiming the gift of prophecy. It is speculated by David Thibodeau in his 1999 book, A Place Called Waco, that he had a sexual relationship with Lewis Rodin, the widow of Benjamin Rodin and leader of the cult, who was then in her late 60s, with Koresh eventually claiming that God had chosen him to father a child with her, who would be the chosen one. In 1983, Lewis allowed Koresh to begin teaching his own message called The Serpent's Root, which caused controversy in the group. Lewis's son, George Rodin, intended to be the cult's next leader and considered Koresh an interloper. When Koresh announced that God had instructed him to marry Rachel Jones, who then added Koresh to her name, there was a short period of calm at the Mount Carmel Center, but it proved only temporary. In the ensuing struggle, George Rodin claimed to have the support of the majority of the cult, forcing Koresh and his group off the property at gunpoint. Koresh and around 25 followers set up camp at Palestine, Texas, 90 miles from Waco, where they lived under rough conditions in buses and tents for the next 2 years. During this time, Koresh undertook recruitment of new followers in California, the United Kingdom, Israel, and Australia. That same year, he traveled to Israel, where he claimed he had a vision that was the modern-day Cyrus. The founder of the branch of the Davidian movement, Victor Hotef, wanted to be God's implement and establish a Davidic kingdom in Palestine. Koresh also wanted to be God's tool and set up a Davidic kingdom in Jerusalem. At least until 1990, he believed the place of his martyrdom might be in Israel. But by 1991, he was convinced that his martyrdom would be in the U.S. instead of Israel. He said the prophecies of Daniel would be fulfilled in Waco and that the Mount Carmel Center was the Davidic kingdom. After being exiled to the Palestine camp, Koresh and his followers eked out a primitive existence. When Lewis died in 1986, he exiled Branch Davidians and wondered if they would ever be able to return to the Mount Carmel Center. But despite the displacement, Koresh now enjoyed the loyalty of the majority of the Branch Davidian community. By late 1987, Rodin's support was in steep decline. To regain it, he challenged Koresh to a contest to raise the dead, going so far as to exhume a corpse to demonstrate his spiritual supremacy. Koresh went to authorities to file charges against Rodin for illegally exhuming a corpse, but was told he would have to show proof, such as a photograph of the corpse. Koresh seized the opportunity to seek criminal prosecution of Rodin by returning to the Mount Carmel Center with 7 armed followers, allegedly attempting to get photographic proof of the crime. Koresh's group was discovered by Rodin and a gunfight broke out. When the sheriff arrived, Rodin had already suffered a minor gunshot wound and was pinned down behind a tree. As a result of the incident, Koresh and his followers were charged with attempted murder. At the trial, Koresh explained that he went to the Mount Carmel Center to uncover evidence of criminal disturbances by a corpse or disturbance of a corpse by Rodin. Koresh's followers were acquitted, and in Koresh's case, a mistrial was declared. In 1989, Rodin murdered Wayne Dale Adair with an axe below the skull after Adair stated his belief that he, Adair, was the true Messiah. Rodin was judged insane and confined to a psychiatric hospital in Big Spring, Texas. Since Rodin owed thousands of dollars in unpaid taxes on the Mount Carmel Center, Koresh and his followers were able to raise the money and reclaim the property. Rodin continued to harass the Koresh faction by filing legal papers while in prison. When Koresh and his followers reclaimed the Mount Carmel Center, they discovered that tenants who had rented from Rodin had left behind a methamphetamine laboratory, which Koresh reported to the local police department and asked to have removed. Vernon Howell filed a petition in California State Superior Court in Pinoma County on March 5, 1990 to legally change his name for publicity and business purposes to David Koresh. On August 28, 1990, Judge Robert Martinez granted the petition. Koresh is the biblical name of Cyrus the Great, a Persian king who was named a Messiah for freeing Jews during the Babylonian captivity. His first name, David, symbolized a lineage directly to the biblical king David, from whom the new Messiah would descend. By taking the name of David Koresh, he was professing himself to be a spiritual descendant of the King David, a Masonic figure carrying out a divinely commissioned errand. Allegations of child abuse and statutory rape, Koresh was alleged to be involved in multiple incidents of child abuse and sexual abuse. And we'll get to that in just a moment here on the Dark Side of Wikipedia. So how much did you know, Carol, about David's, rise to power that we just learned about?
The interesting thing is as you were reading that, I was like, I never knew any of it. I never heard any of that.
No.
Because really the story you hear just surrounds the tragedy.
Yeah.
And it was tragic. Like,
sure.
No way around that. And like kind of his crazy preacher, I don't know,
yeah,
and his followers, like you hear the cult side of that. But like, I didn't know his mom was 14.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the guy wasn't even set up well for this world.
No, not at all. I mean, and that's where you get an individual like that, that can be, you know, so charming and so innocent. And, you know, at the same time.
And he was handsome, too. So yeah, people, you know, give him a pass because he's good looking. And
yeah, I thought it was just interesting when to hear some of the ways that people might have been looking at things, where it's like, well, he was expecting his dad to pass the cult down to him. And then the other guy showed up and took the cult over. Like, how on that is like goes against all the rules of cults. You know, it's like, what are the rules of cults? You know? So.
And the martyrdom is going to be here. No, it's going to be there. It's going to be in Waco, Texas. Like, what?
Yeah. And I, you know, obviously, the best thing to happen to Waco, you know, I don't know, I guess publicity wise, since then would be Joanna Gaines and
yeah,
HGTV.
Kind of Waco, they're probably like, thank God for a Magnolia.
Yeah, no shit. I mean, I that's in terms of giving them something positive to be looked at for. That has been a great thing from a perspective of someone far away from there. But the thing is, too, it really wasn't. I mean, it's outside of Waco. Waco is just the reference point because that's the thing everybody knows. Like, where is it? By Waco. Oh, it's in Waco. Yeah. And that's kind of how it went.
And I don't think there's anything to see at this point. Now, I went. They might have erected like a monument or something.
No,
I don't even know if they've done that.
I could be wrong on this, but I believe. So if I'm wrong, this is. I'm not professing this to be fact. I believe they're still around. I believe the Branch Davidians are still around to this day, and they are, I believe, on the same plot of land. I think there's some monuments there. And I do not know the belief system. From what I can recall, from what I've seen some documentaries on, I think they look down on Koresh as a misguided person, but more so like the principles of their belief system are upheld far beyond that individual.
Well, I hope that's the case. I hope they do think he is misguided, because he was definitely misguided.
Sure. I think that's where it stands, but I could stand corrected on that. Let's continue on our story here of David Koresh as things continue to go kind of a dark path for him. Allegations of child abuse and statutory rape. Koresh was alleged to be involved in multiple incidents of child abuse and child sexual abuse. His doctrine of the House of David did lead to marriages with both married and single women in the group, reportedly including with at least one underage girl. The underage girl was Michelle Jones, the younger sister of Koresh's legal wife, Rachel. and the daughter of lifelong Branch Davidians Perry and Mary Bell Jones. A six-month investigation of child abuse allegations by the Texas Child Protection Services in 1992 failed to turn up any evidence, possibly because the Branch Davidians concealed the spiritual marriage of Koresh to Michelle, assigning a surrogate husband, David Thibodeau, to the girl for the sake of appearances. Regarding the allegations of child abuse, the evidence is less than certain. In a widely reported incident, ex-members claimed that Koresh became irritated with the cries of his son Cyrus and spanked the child severely for several minutes on three consecutive visits to the child's bedroom. In a second report, a man involved in a custody battle visited the Mount Carmel Center and claimed to have seen the beating of a young boy with a stick. Finally, the FBI's justification for forcing an end to the 51-day standoff was predicated on the charge that Koresh was abusing children inside the Mount Carmel Center. There were allegations he had fathered children with underage girls in his cult. In hours following the deadly confrontation, Attorney General Janet Reno told reporters that we had specific information that babies were being beaten. However, FBI Director William Sessions publicly denied the charge and told reporters that they had no such information about the child abuse inside the Mount Carmel Center. A careful examination of the other child abuse charges found the evidence to be weak and ambiguous, casting doubt on the allegations. The allegations of child abuse stem largely from distractors and ex-members. The 1993 Justice Department report cites allegations of child abuse and physical abuse. Legal scholars point out that the ATF had no legal jurisdiction in the matter of child protection, and it appears that these accounts were inserted by the ATF to inflame the case against Koresh. For example, the account of former Branch Davidian Janine Buns is reproduced in an affidavit. She claimed that Koresh had fathered at least 15 children with various women and girls, and that she had personally delivered seven of the infants. Buns also claims that Koresh would annul all marriages of couples who joined the group and had exclusive sexual access to the women and girls. Koresh fathered multiple children by different women in the group. His House of David doctrine was based on a purported revelation that involved the protection of 24 children by chosen women in the community. These 24 children were to serve as the ruling elders over the millennium after the return of Christ. In his book, James Thibodeau states that Koresh acknowledged on a videotape sent out of the compound during the standoff that he had fathered more than 12 children by several wives. On March 3, 1993, during negotiations to secure the release of the remaining children, Koresh advised the negotiating team that my children are different than those others, referring to his direct lineage versus those children previously released. The siege began on February 28, 1993, when the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms raided Mount Carmel Center. The ensuing gun battle resulted in the deaths of four agents and six Branch Davidians. Shortly after the initial raid, the FBI hostage rescue team took command of the federal operation because the FBI had jurisdiction over incidents involving the deaths of federal agents. The negotiating team established contact with Koresh inside the compound. Communication over the next 51 days, including telephone exchanges with their various FBI negotiators, Koresh himself had been seriously injured by a gunshot as the standoff continued. Koresh and his closest male leaders negotiated delays, possibly so that he could write religious documents he said he needed to complete before he surrendered. His conversations with the negotiators were dense and included biblical imagery. The federal negotiators treated the situation as a hostage crisis. Let's stop there before we get into the siege and how it all ended. So that part, a lot of it is what we, I think, remember seeing in the news as it was going on. Maybe not in as great of detail as we're looking at it retrospectively, but obviously that was the big part at the or as it was going on over all those weeks.
Yeah, there's just so many things. You know, there's so many places along the way that somebody could have made a different decision, including him and including the people who followed him.
Yeah.
Including all the FBI and alcohol, tobacco, and firearms people. you know, there's Janet Reno.
Yeah.
There's so many people who could have made other decisions along the way. And now that you hear, like, as you're hearing the story and you think of, and you knowing what happened, mm-hmm. it's just so sad. And it just seems like it should have been preventable. And there were kids involved. Yeah.
It does. It very much does. You know, it seems like there was, I mean, I don't know if it was just because, you know, I was at the age I was at and I'm starting to kind of really get a grasp on the world as these things are happening. But to me, I mean, it feels like this sort of stuff, the Waco thing and then Oklahoma City, which were really very close to each other in terms of timeline. It was kind of like a turning point, it felt like, with our country of like, beginning down kind of a dark road, and then eventually we get to 9/11. Because we, in between there, then we would have, you know, the mass amount of school shootings would begin to go up with Columbine, and there was several plane crashes. I mean, it was just kind of there was a lot that went on in that window that were just kind of leading up, and we thought was peaceful, but all of a sudden, boom. 9/11.
Because when you think about it, even today with all of the protesting and things,
yeah,
I'm dumbfounded so often that why aren't de-escalation practices practiced?
Yeah,
it seems like escalation.
Yeah,
it's like de-escalate this situation
mm-hmm.
as quick as you can. There are children in there. We do not want to hurt the children.
Yeah.
And you know, he had a lot of food in there, and like they could have sat in there for months. But really, like eventually they'd have to come out.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that he would have. I don't know that there was ever a good ending to this story. But I don't know. I've had several conversations recently about mm-hmm. why aren't these situations de-escalated before they're escalated?
Yeah. That's just something that seems that needs a lot of looking at because clearly when things escalate too fast in a ridiculous manner, there is not a good end to it for either side in almost every case. So let's continue on here. This is where we jump into the siege time of Mount Carmel. The siege of Mount Carmel ended 51 days later on April 19th, 1993, when U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno approved recommendations of FBI officials to proceed with a final advance in which the Branch Davidians were to be removed from their building by force. In attempt to flush Koresh from the stronghold, the FBI reported to pumping CS gas from a M728 combat engineer vehicle with a battering ram into the compound. In the course of the advance on the compound, the church building caught fire in circumstances that are still disputed. Barricaded inside the building, 79 Branch Davidians perished in the ensuing blaze. 21 of these victims were children under the age of 16. According to the FBI, Steve Schneider's, Koresh's right-hand man, who probably realized he was dealing with a fraud, shot and killed Koresh and then committed suicide with the same gun. A second account gave a totally different story. Koresh, then 33, died of a gunshot wound to the head during the course of the fire. No one knows who killed him or if he killed himself. The medical examiner reported that although federal law enforcement personnel fired no shots that day, 20 people, including 5 children under the age of 14, had been shot, and a 3-year-old had been stabbed in the chest. Koresh is buried at Memorial Park Cemetery in Tyler, Texas. In the Last Supper section, several of David Koresh's albums were released, including Voice of Fire in 1994. In 2004, Koresh's 1968 Chevrolet Cameo, which had been damaged during the raid, sold for $37,000 at auction. It is now owned by Ghost Adventures host Zach Baggins. Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols cited the Mount Carmel Center raid as motivation for the Oklahoma City bombing of April 19, 1995, timed to coincide with the second anniversary of the Waco assault. On January 23, 2009, Koresh's mother, Bonnie Clark Holdman, was stabbed to death in Chandler, Texas. Her sister, Beverly Clark, was charged with murder. Four documentary films have been made about the siege, including different versions of Waco, The Rules of Engagement, Waco, A New Revelation, Waco, The Big Lie, and Waco, Madman or Messiah. In 2018, BBC Radio 5 Live created a radio podcast, End of Days, about the death of the life of David Koresh and his involvement in the Waco siege and the recruitment of people from Nottingham, Manchester, and London. The Court TV channel, television series Mugshots released an episode about David Koresh as well. So obviously, quite a man of interest, as we all remember from those days. But if you weren't around in those days, it was a thing. It was something that was talked about quite a bit. You know, what's interesting to me right now, and tell me if you agree, are we just not seeing these stories now because we are so buried in everything else that, you know, these things just aren't news anymore?
Well, I mean, that this particular story would be huge news.
I would think today. So, yeah.
But the cult thing, you don't really hear about cults.
No, I mean, are there less of them, or is it more of a everybody do their own thing thing?
I don't know.
Yeah.
No, I would think there would be just as many of them.
I mean, with all,
you know, when you think about like people in Doomsday and people who believe, well, there was recently that couple where they found the children,
yeah,
their remains on the guy's property.
Yeah.
But they were into this doomsday and the world's going to end on July 20th or something like that.
Oh, God. Okay.
I mean, I definitely think they're still around. I think they're underground is kind of by nature what they do.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Or it's right in our faces and we don't even realize it. It's like secretly all of the employees of Taco Bell are all part of this thing. And it's like, oh my God.
But man, they sure do make a good 7-layer burrito.
Like, I always wondered why you worked at a Taco Bell. You seem like you had so much more potential. And it's like, it's because I'm part of the fucking cult. I was a brain surgeon and I knew what was going to happen. Like, no shit. Can I get that chalupa meal now? Thank you. So yeah, that's what it's going to be. It's either in broad daylight or it is super underground.
And probably both in a way.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, not as obvious as Taco Bell, but yeah. I mean, I think that there's, I don't know. I mean, we're in a different world in a different place, obviously.
But like that couple that with that story is so horrific to me with the children.
Yeah.
But that, like, there's 144,000 of you that will be saved and goes on into the next whatever.
Yeah.
Like, what I don't get is if some guy came to me and told me that I think you are one of the 144,000, mm-hmm. and like you're like top notch, like you might be one of the top 100 people, I'd be like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like I wouldn't even kind of buy into that. But I think there are people in this world who are unbalanced enough that they do.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like, this whole David Koresh thing, like the Jonestown massacre, you and I were talking about it before we started.
Yeah.
But the drinking the Flavor Aid, not Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
I don't know. Killing a child, I can't imagine, like, here, drink this.
No.
Mommy says so. But then this story, these kids were shot and stabbed.
Yeah.
Like, how could you do that?
Some of that is disputed.
Like, break a window and throw your kid out and say, run.
Yeah.
Even if you weren't going to leave, like, I just don't understand that mentality.
The level of devotion that some can have to, and I don't want to say this is a religion, but to a madman, is scary. I mean, that you could get that devoted and you can be that strong of a follower.
Well, and if you think about it, what he told those people really did come true to them.
Yeah. And so everything was lining up.
He's going to go to Waco for the martyrdom,
yeah,
which happened. And then he tells them what they're like, how evil these outsiders are and the government is. Yeah. And this is what they're going to do. And they did it.
Mm-hmm. And while not doing anything externally to anyone that would cause any problems, but certainly internally in his compound, his little fucked up sex ring and his sex rules, you know,
like, how do you, how, I don't even get how you'd wrap your brain around.
No.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really like him having sex with my child.
I mean, has there ever been a cult where it doesn't get fucked up with somebody's sexual desires? I mean, cause if you think of this, if you take the sex shit out of it and you have nothing. I mean, as long as he's not abusing the kids and there's nothing else going on and everybody's just happy and they're good and he's not like unmarrying people or marrying other people's wives and having sex with their daughters and shit. If you take that out and he wasn't doing that, what, you know, I mean, they probably would have taken him down on like gun charges and stuff because he was hoarding that stuff. But really, you know, has there been a maybe that's the answer. Maybe the cults that are out there aren't doing that sort of shit. And that's why they're still in business. And we haven't heard about
them. A lot of them are, though.
Yeah, you're probably right.
That power goes to their head.
Yeah.
And they think they can manipulate these people however they want to and get whatever they want.
Yeah.
It's many men are driven by sexual urges.
Yeah.
And so to them, it's all done in the name of religion.
I think, you know, cults.
I'm the chosen one.
I think
of
cults.
Of course you want your child to have sex with a chosen one.
Who wouldn't? I mean, fuck, he said he's the chosen one. Must be the chosen one. Here's my, here's Tony's dark predictions of the next 20 years. I need like some sort of spooky music for it. Like, cause this could, I should totally start doing this. And then we check it like 5 years from now. Tony's dark predictions of the next 20 years. I think cults are going to make a comeback. I do. I think
we're primed up for it, actually.
We are so, so tribal with everything. And then even if you're on the same page as people, if you're not like in the right paragraph on the correct sentence with the right word, then you are totally fucking off in the minds of a lot of people. So it's gotten that tribal. It's not just, hey, we're all generally for the same thing, or even, hey, we are for the same thing, but we have, you know, we're different people. Now it's like, we are the fucking exact same person. And if you are not the exact same fucking person, you are shit. So that's where I think
it's kind of crazy like that. Now.
Yeah.
Like you, if you're going to be Republican or Democrat, you have to fit these molds.
That's such a generic like, term, you know,
God,
it's like, it's insane. But anyway, that we are so, segmented right now. I think that's the thing. And you need to have like micro segments to pull off a cult. You can't do a cult pretty very well with a big group of people. I mean, that's where you start doing like, you know, that's where you get Hitler type shit going on. But you can do a cult when it's micro sected down. So I think we're going to see in the next 20, 30 years, a lot of these kind of broken off communities that have their own little systems. And essentially it's a cult. Maybe it's going to start out more innocently. It's like a co-op or something. But I think you're going to see some of that stuff where it's like, we're good. We don't really like the city life. We don't like this or that. We're out here all kind of together. And then, you know, later you find out there's a leader and it's dark and all that sort of shit.
Yeah, it just takes one twisted person who's charismatic.
Yeah, it really does.
David Koresh was twisted for, I think, probably, like, it was shit that happened to him along the way.
Yeah.
But he was twisted, very charismatic.
Yep.
And found the right group and twisted it into what he... It's one of those things I still can't wrap my brain around. Like I said earlier, he's so at fault, you know, because these people are blindly following him. But there was this whole governmental issue. Like, could they have handled this differently?
Yeah.
Because I remember watching it on TV. I had just started in radio and we were in the newsroom watching it. And like, I was like, holy shit, there's like fire.
Yeah.
And what the hell? And because it was like live cameras were there. So you could watch this happen live.
Yep.
And it was, and you'd seen the buildup. We talked about it at work. Like, there is no way this will end well.
Yeah.
You know, these people aren't going to walk out. But it's like there are kids in there. So Like, I couldn't wrap my brain. I still can't wrap my brain around that. There were kids in there. And how did nobody want to save those children? They're innocent.
Yeah.
Like, you could be all twisted and following David Koresh, but your kid was just your kid. Like, didn't have a say in it. That just bugs me.
Yeah. It's one of those things. I do highly recommend checking out that documentary. They're not supporting the show or anything like that today, but the documentary, or it's not a documentary, it's a drama. Series on Netflix.
It's pretty good. I saw it first time.
It was an interesting look, and obviously, you know, it's a perspective, but it humanizes it a lot more than just the news, which I think is important to have on this one, because there's a lot of ways it can look, you know, I mean, it is horrible no matter what, but it's a lot of ways it can be skewed one way or another. Interesting way thing to check out if you're interested in the case at all. If you're more of a just documentary person going, I hate the actual docudramas. It's a good one. It's done well. So, all right. That's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you are downloading us. Leave us a review on iTunes. We'd greatly appreciate it. For Carol, I'm Tony. Thanks for listening to The Dark Side of Wikipedia.